Let's jump in. Your homework for this past week was to read something that was written by one of our defenders of the faith, those superheroes that I gave to you last week. Gave you some options for reading. Any thoughts, comments on what you read?
The brave people.
Yes.
I thought it was intriguing that Justin and Trifo both weren't well versed in Hebrew, but they still had this debate.
Yeah.
I was like, how did they save all this stuff, knowing that they hated what they stood for? So I was thankful that it was published and saved.
Yeah. And that's one of the, so we'll get there, probably not, I don't know if we'll get there this session or not, but one of the biggest reasons that we have all of these ancient writings really comes down to the works and ministries of one particular man. Any guesses on who that is? Shot in the dark.
Martin Luther.
Good guess, but not Martin Luther. We have a holiday that we celebrate every March in his name.
St. Patrick.
So Patrick, we'll get there, but one of the things that Patrick did was when his story's incredible, but when he ministered and evangelized the pirates, essentially, of Ireland, they did not know how to read, they did not know how to write, and so he taught them how to read and write by actually translating and making their own copies of all of these ancient works. And so that they could have it and read it for themselves and learn how to read and write by writing Justin Martyr and just copying word for word what he wrote and how they did it. Because eventually when Rome falls and the Goths come in and burn the city to the ground, they destroy everything. And so there's no copies of writings, there's no letters, there's no nothing. But then you have over here in Ireland this little monk and his band of Irish pirates who have just written copies of everything. And so we have it because of that. There's a great book, if you like to read, there's a great book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. And it's all about that ministry and that work. All right, anyway, any other comments, thoughts, questions from your reading?
So, yeah. Tertullian had a really good defense of communion.
Yes.
Dealing with the heresies. But it also seemed like it led him to have a slightly different view of what the elements were. It wasn't quite as extreme as what Catholicism seems to be like, but it's still headed in that direction where it actually assumes some degree of
transubstantiation, where the bread is not the bread, but it's actually his flesh and it's actually his blood. Yeah, the doctrine of transubstantiation that the Catholic Church eventually develops and grabs onto isn't developed for a couple centuries, but it has its roots in the guys like Tertullian and others who I don't think intended to lead their words to lead that way, but essentially you had some in the church that just grabbed some of the things that they said that Tertullian and others said and said, this is, and then pairing that with the words of Jesus that unless anyone eats my flesh and drinks my blood, he has no part of me. It just sort of combined and sort of morphed into transubstantiation. I don't think Tertullian believed that, but I think his writings influenced it. Yeah. It's good. Anything else? Did you like what you read? Didn't like what you read? I'm okay if you didn't like it. Just want to know.
Cyprian pretty much convinced himself that was immoral, gave up everything.
Yeah. We see a lot of that throughout church history. There's one guy that's a little bit closer to our time, and I am blanking on his name. With his writings and ministry and career, I read about him in seminary. I think that if it were today's money, as a pastor and a writer, he made the equivalent of something like $500,000-$600,000 a year, but chose to live off of $20,000 a year and just gave everything else away and said, this is what I need. This is what is necessary. This is what can be used for others.
The other thing is stood out to me is it's helping me start to form answers that are true, like when biblical stuff is attacked.
Yeah.
Instead of just not knowing what to say or giving my own opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's roots, right? Like, church history is important, and we talked about this in our first week. Like, church history matters because it gives us roots. That we're not just here figuring things out on our own. We're not just developing theology and saying, we believe this because we believe this. Like, we're standing on the shoulders of 2,000 years of brothers and sisters. And so, it's good to have that solid ground to dig into those roots. It's good. All right, so this morning, we're talking about persecution. Really how it ramped up and kind of doing some recap where we've already talked about like the persecution of Nero, but really looking at what the first three centuries of persecution looked like and how that impacted the church theologically, and then there's a church issue that we will deal with. So let's dive in and really just kind of breaking this down where you've got sort of the Caesars of Rome against the Lord Jesus Christ. The Caesars had this very, very determined outlook. And one of the biggest reasons that Christians, the emperors persecuted Christians was because of the claim that Christians made. Jesus is Lord. And they did this in the world where the only response, the only appropriate phrasing of that sentence was not Jesus is Lord, but Caesar is Lord. And so the Christians very much were seen as these subversive, insubordinate people who were trying to overthrow Caesar by bowing down to another king. And so Caesar, the Caesars throughout Rome did not like them. They hated them. And some of them took drastic steps to put an end to them. So we have Nero. You remember Nero? He was the emperor who killed Peter and Paul, who's responsible for that. He came to power and we talked about this, I think, our first week, where within the first few years of his reign, he decided that Rome was too trashy of a city and he wanted to remake it. But the problem was is that people lived there and there were buildings there and you can't just demolish homes. And so Nero set the city on fire and burned it to the ground. He burned down 10 of the 14 districts. And of course, as anyone would, the people got mad. They got mad, and Nero, to kind of push back some of the blame, said, I didn't do it, it was those Christians. And so Nero blames the fire on the Christians, he stirs up public resentment against them, and begins to persecute and kill Christians. But as we said that first week, the persecution of Nero was almost exclusively confined to the city of Rome. It didn't stretch out past the city, it didn't go into other parts of the empire, it stayed in Rome. And ultimately, the persecution ends when Nero dies in AD 68. And so the persecution just sort of stops. Then in AD 81, we have a new Caesar. There's obviously Caesars in between, but nothing in regards to the church or anything important really happened with these emperors. We don't know much about them. So we have Domitian in AD 81. He is the first emperor. The thing that stands out about Domitian is he's the first emperor to claim divinity while still ruling. So Roman Empire, Roman culture believed that their emperors, that Caesars were divine. But for the most part, practically, they weren't treated as gods until after they died. And it was after their death that most people, they would pray and offer sacrifices and bow down to the statues of deceased emperors. Domitian's the first guy who says, while he's still reigning and still alive, I'm God and you should worship me. You should offer sacrifices to me. You should burn incense to me. And so he actually makes it a law to worship him. All inhabitants of Rome must worship at my statue. Now, there's two groups in the Roman Empire who have a big problem with this and can't do it. Who are they? Jews and Christians. And so what happens is Domitian orders his soldiers and orders his government to persecute both Christians and Jews together. Simply for the fact that they will not worship him. They will not offer sacrifices to his statues. This is not an empire-wide persecution, but it did extend into some of the bigger cities of Asia Minor, like Ephesus. It is during Domitian's rule that most likely he is the emperor who exiles the Apostle John to the Isle of Patmos, where he writes the book of Revelation. So again, just like Nero, when Domitian dies, the persecution stops temporarily. And really, that's what we know about the first century persecution. Nero and Domitian are the two big guys. Persecution, it happens, but it's relatively small. It's confined. It's not the big stuff, not yet. In the second century, Christianity becomes illegal by the second century and punishable by death if you were discovered to be a Christian. We don't know exactly when this law goes into effect, but we do know that it happened before AD 111. Because in that year, we get a guy named Pliny of Bithynia who writes a letter. And Pliny is this priest, Roman priest turned politician, which always is a great combination. Anytime you can mix religion and politics all in the same person, you're set up for great success. So Pliny is this priest politician. He becomes a Roman governor. He's like Pontius Pilate. He's responsible for an area of the Roman Empire. And he is realizing that within his province, Christians are growing. The churches are growing. And it's illegal for Christians to be there. So he actually writes a letter, which we still have, to the emperor. The emperor Trajan. Thank you. Couldn't find his name. Emperor Trajan asking him what he should do about all these Christians. And so in this letter, he details his reports and says, this is what I've done so far. He actually says that he sent female spies into the churches in his area. Like, I need you to go in there, pretend you're a Christian, and find out everything you can about them. And the women come back and report that the Christians don't do any of the things that people are saying about them. Like, they're not cannibals, even though they eat the flesh and the blood. They're not incestuous, even though they call their husbands and wives brothers and sisters. Like, none of the things that people are saying about Christians are true. They actually seem like pretty decent people. And so Pliny then writes this letter going, I don't know what to do with them. Do I kill them? Do I hunt them down? Do I just leave them be and hope that they just continue being good citizens like they have been? And Trajan, the emperor, actually writes that back and says, don't go looking for them. But if you find them, you need to kill them. And so he sort of adopts this, like, don't ask, don't tell policy. Like, you don't have to make out any big search parties or any big interrogations. Just don't go looking for Christians. But if you happen to find them, you got to kill them because it's the law. So the empire really in the second century becomes more, the empire emperors become more concerned. Their biggest threat, their biggest issue with Christians is that they are a threat to the Roman way of life. They're a threat to the culture. You have guys like some emperors like Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius, he didn't hate Christians so much, but as he loved Roman culture. He loved the gods and goddesses. He loved the pagan arts. He loved the civilization, the entertainment, all of the things that made Rome, Rome. Marcus Aurelius loved it. And the Christians didn't. And he saw that as a problem. He saw it as a threat. And so under his reign, Marcus Aurelius begins persecuting Christians and equates it with this protection of the Roman culture. We have to kill Christians to protect our way of life. And so under his reign, you've got several prominent deaths and persecutions that we know about. One particular was a woman named Felicitas, different from the one that you'll read about in your homework. But Felicitas was a very wealthy, high upper class widow in Rome. So she ran with all the inner circles of the Caesar and she was as high up as you can be as a citizen. And she had seven sons, and all seven of her sons and herself were all believers, which was a big deal. Marcus Aurelius finds out that she's a believer, that all of her sons are believers, and he arrests them and brings them before the public and says and tells her she needs to recant. Her sons need to recant their faith, turn away from Jesus, or suffer the consequences. And Felicitas says, I can't do that. And so Marcus Aurelius then builds seven altars to the Roman gods and lays each one of her seven sons on each one and sacrifices them all simultaneously in front of her, in front of the crowds. And then says to her again, recant, or the same shall happen to you. And she says, I can't. And so then she is killed, which is a huge, huge deal for the Romans. Because it's one thing to kill peasants. It's one thing to kill people that don't matter. I say that in their minds. All people matter. But it's one thing to kill people that are not thought of. It's quite a different thing to kill the upper class in Rome. And so Marcus Aurelius kills Felicitas, he kills her sons, and he kills them and says in her death, "Let this be an example to the rest of you. We will not put up with it." And so the message from Felicitas' death from the emperor is that if someone like her, this wealthy upper class person, if someone like her is not safe, then none of you are. And each emperor for the second century had this sort of, had a different approach to Christians. Some of them hunted them, some of them let them be, but none really loved them. Some of them especially hated them. But the second century just sort of comes and goes. Christians die, Christians survive, life goes on. Third century is when things become hard. Persecution intensifies to its worst. The worst that it is has ever been in the Roman Empire or ever will be. Every emperor in the third century now attempts to rid the empire of Christians completely. This becomes a primary goal. Like if Caesars campaigned, one of their campaign mottos would be no more Christians in Rome. Like they pushed for this. This was going to be the defining legacy of each Caesar's reign. I'm going to be the guy who eliminates Christianity. And so you have a couple of emperors that matter. You've got Septimius Severus. In 202, he mandates the death of all new converts and church teachers. And this is different from all the other laws and mandates, because Severus doesn't want to enact this massive bloodshed across the empire. He doesn't want to just go around and kill everybody. But what he wants to do is he wants to stop the church from growing. And so he says, I'm going to kill their teachers and I'm going to kill any new additions. And we're just going to nip this thing off at the bud. And so under his reign, Perpetua is killed. Perpetua and Felicitas. That's your homework there at the back. We'll talk about that in a minute. But you'll read the account of her martyrdom under Severus's reign. It's this book, you'll notice it's written by two different authors. One of them is Perpetua herself. So a lot of it's written in the first person. She's telling her own story. But the details that couldn't have been written, because like the details of her death, she didn't have time to write them afterwards. So someone else has written them for her as they saw it. Very, very inspiring, very touching, very difficult. Perpetua was pregnant or had just recently given birth at the time of her arrest. And so there's a lot of back and forth with her father, and her father's pleading with her to recant for the sake of her son, for the sake of her children. She doesn't. But it's, you'll read it and you'll see. So that's Severus. Then we have Decius. Decius is hands down one of the worst emperors from a Christian perspective. He is a Roman military general, and he leads a coup. He leads a revolt against the current Caesar and becomes emperor himself in 249. So like Marcus Aurelius before, he is a lover of all things Roman. He loves traditions and loves the culture. But when Decius comes to power, he looks around at the Roman way of life and he sees that Rome is actually in decline. Things are just sort of falling apart. No one's really as Roman as they once were, and they're not as excited about all things Rome as they once were, and this is just, it's creating a problem. Roman culture is falling apart, and Decius says, it's those Christians. It's their fault. In 247, so 2 years before he becomes emperor, Christians angered a lot of people by refusing to celebrate and join in the pagan festivities that they had done to mark, to celebrate the 1,000th anniversary of the founding of Rome. As you can imagine, that would be a big deal for the people of Rome. The big deal for the Roman culture. Christians said, not for us. And it angered a lot of people. The next year, in 248, Rome has suffered a series of invasions from the northern Germanic tribes known as the Goths. The Goths have started invading and coming into the Roman Empire. It's the first time they've ever been invaded. And Roman way of life is under attack. Who's at fault? It's those Christians. And so in 249, Decius becomes emperor, and he blames the Christians for everything. And he decides that it's his mission to eliminate the church completely. He's not going to leave one Christian left. And so he initiates the first empire-wide persecution of Christians. He targets church leaders. He executes the bishops of Rome, the bishop of Antioch, and the bishop of Jerusalem. Just goes in, arrests them, kills them. Cyprian of Carthage, who you read about last week, or we talked a little bit about, well, he is in Carthage, and he actually escapes. He flees the city, and he goes into hiding. Origen is captured, and he is tortured, but kept alive for a few months before dying from his injuries years later. So he targets church leaders. Decius also creates a new law. Decius says that everyone must offer a sacrifice to the gods, the Roman gods, and burn incense at a statue at an altar to Decius. And when you do this, you will be given a certificate proving that you've done it. And then he says, you have 1 year to get a certificate. In a year, anyone who does not have one will be killed, Christian or not. And so these libellis is what they were called in Latin. These certificates are given out to those that burn incense in public, that pray to and worship false gods. But anyone who doesn't is killed after a year. And so the church really kind of, during this persecution, becomes a division of three different groups of people. You have some that are called the confessors because they refused. They refused to burn incense. They confessed Christ publicly and died for it. Then on the other end of the group, you have the apostates. Those who said, yeah, you want me to burn incense? Not a big deal. I will do it to save my skin. And the church looked at them and said, apostasy. You've left Christ. You've abandoned. You've turned away. And then somewhere along the middle between confessors and apostates, you've got this group of Christians that conformed outwardly. They burned incense, but only to protect their children, to save their families. They still remained faithful Christians. They still remained true, but they just did something external that did not affect internal. And so then in this middle group, you've also have some Christians that figured out a way how to purchase a certificate on the Roman black market and found a way to get their hands on it without actually doing the sacrifice. And so you've got the church sort of divided. You've got those that died for their faith, those that left the faith, and then everything in the middle. And so Decius, 2 years into his reign, dies in battle. And the church gets a 2 year break from persecution. They get 2 years where they don't have to worry about being hunted and killed. And everyone just sort of breathes. We'll come back to this 2 year break in a minute. Because when that 2 year period ends, another emperor takes over, Valerian. And he renews and escalates the persecution even more. So Valerian prohibits all gatherings of Christians. And he outlaws Christian worship entirely. And he kills every church leader he can find. He executes three consecutive bishops of Rome. One after another after another. Valerian even kills Cyprian of Carthage. And it's more of the same for the church. You've got some Christians that stay true and die. You've got some that cave and they stop gathering and they protect themselves. They protect their family. And some just sort of find a middle road. But what do you think happens to the church during this persecution? It grows. Why? I mean, let's say you were not a Christian in 3rd century Rome, and you see every Christian that you've known now being executed by the government. Why would you become a Christian? Why would the church grow during this?
They saw go ahead.
No, you're good. Go ahead.
They saw what was happening and they knew it was
Okay, yeah.
Found the group that went to where they were saved.
Yeah, there's an aspect of the Roman citizens looked at the church and had compassion for them.
Yeah.
I wanted to know more about it. There's also, of course, obviously, grace of God. Big reason why the church grows. Not only that they were willing to die for it, but the manner in which they received their death was unheard of. I mean, you'll read about it in the Perpetua Martyrdom. But just her response, I mean, you have her father holding her newborn son outside of her prison cell going, "Please, let this go. Your child needs you to live." And as the Roman soldiers and the Roman governor and the crowds are watching this interaction, and you see this woman, and it actually says that her breasts are still leaking from having just given birth. Like, you see this new mother look at her father and her newborn son and say, "What I have is better. This is worth losing that." Yeah, that would catch some eyes. Tertullian, we've talked about him already this morning. We talked about him last week. But Tertullian actually writes a very famous line. "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. It is where martyrs die and spill their blood, from there springs churches."
Who was the one that died? He was blind and was burned. Or wasn't blind, he was just really old.
Polycarp?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like, "Go ahead."
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't.
Not a bit. And you see that from, I mean, it's not just like these one or two Christians that died this way. Like, almost every Christian that was martyred has some sort of, that we have record of, has some sort of experience where they embraced it. They didn't run from it. Like Ignatius, for example, he found out that the Romans were hunting him, and he initially like took a few steps to go into hiding and protect himself. And then after that realized, "What am I running from?" And actually walked out into the Roman soldiers and said, "I'm right here. Come on, let's do it." And so the persecution fails, like terribly, terribly fails. If it neither stops church growth nor eliminates Christians from the empire, persecution actually causes the church to grow. Historians say that at the end of the Valerian persecution, so the end of this last emperor that we've just talked about, Christians make up anywhere from 25% to 40% of the Roman Empire. They are almost half at this point. But one of the things that we need to talk about when we talk about persecution like this is what it did to the church. We talk about what it did to the empire and how the church grew, but internally, things developed and happened, and the church had to address them, particularly within that 2-year gap between Decius and Valerian. And so you get this theology of persecution that develops within the church. I mean, we look at these martyrs and we read their stories and we hear about their deaths and we go, "Wow, that is inspiring. That is encouraging. That is incredible." The contemporaries of those martyrs did the exact same thing. These martyrs actually become heroes of the church. And you get these accounts of their death that are sad, but at the same time inspiring and beautiful. And it becomes increasingly common for Christians to not just embrace martyrdom when it comes, but to actually go seek it out. This culture of martyrdom becomes almost, it just envelops the church, where Christians are now saying, "The best thing that I can do for Christ, the best thing that I can do as a Christian, is to go find a Roman soldier and have him kill me, because I will be doing it for Christ." And the church has to develop this and say, like, well, if you go seeking persecution, that doesn't make you a martyr. But if persecution comes and kills you, then you are a martyr. And so it really just this martyrdom theology ends up developing over time into this cult of martyrs, where you've got the clothes and the bones of the martyrs are increasingly seen as these holy relics, special items. And the church just sort of slowly begins this adoption of holy days on the days where these martyrs died. We still have them around today. Name me a couple. St. Patrick's Day? What else? The month before St. Patrick's Day? Valentine's Day. St. Valentine. Like, we still have these days where there's a celebration of a certain martyr, of a certain saint. And this sort of just develops over the course of time as the church just begins not just celebrating and thanking God for these martyrs, but it slowly morphs into almost a worship of these martyrs. And the big reason for this, if we can step into third century Christian shoes for a moment and try to understand how this happened, a big reason for this is the underground church. And I mean that quite literally, underground church. Because during the times of Decius and Valerian, the church in Rome especially had to meet underground. They went down into places where no one in Rome would ever find them, the catacombs, the graveyards that were underneath the city of Rome. And the reason they went there was because, one, it was safe. No one's coming down there. No one's going to find them there. It's illegal to meet publicly, and the catacombs were both large enough and private enough that the church could meet safely. But something happens when you meet in a graveyard, especially when that graveyard is made up of the brothers and sisters who've died from the persecution. I mean, you're standing there in, if you put yourself in their shoes, you're standing there in this dark underground cemetery. And all along the walls and under your feet are buried Christians who've died for the faith. You are standing on their graves, leaning up against the walls where they are buried in. And so the church becomes this place where you're worshiping where your heroes are buried. And so, of course, it just sort of morphs into and becomes the celebration of these faithful saints. But that's the theology. There's a church issue that arises from the persecution. And this is where we get this go back to this 2-year gap between Decius and Valerian. And remember the divide of the church. You've got some that confessed and stayed true and died, and you've got some that lapsed and left and never came back. And then you've got some everywhere in the middle. And so what do you do if under the persecution of Decius, a family of Christians, wife, husband, wife, 3 young little Roman kids, decide that to save their children from a horrible death, they're going to burn incense at a statue and not worship Decius, but they're just going to do it to save their children's lives. And they know that it's not safe to gather with the Christians anymore, so they just sort of worship together as a family at home privately, but don't meet with the church. They've got their certificate to keep them safe. They want to remain faithful Christians, but they're doing it secretly. Decius dies. Persecution ends. Now this family leaves their home, comes back to the church and says, "It's so good to be back here with you all. We're so glad to be able to come back and worship with you." What does the church do? What would you do? Not a rhetorical question. What would you do? All right, we got a couple take backs. Okay, welcome back.
Before you welcome them back, they have to repent.
Okay, so welcome them back with repentance.
Yeah.
I don't know, but yes. Other thoughts? Any opposing views? Okay.
And what it looks like after this change of heart.
Yeah. Okay. So we call these, or they called them, lapsed Christians. Lapsed Christians were the ones who recanted their faith during persecution or did something against the Christian faith to save themselves or to save their family. And then once the persecution ended, wanted to rejoin the church and continue in the faith. So they called them at the time, we still look back and call them lapsed Christians. And the big question is, not should we receive them back? That That's not the primary issue. The primary issue is, are they Christians or not? Because yes, we should receive them back. If someone wants to come and be a part of the church, absolutely. But before we receive anybody, I mean, we here at Bear Creek still hold a strong view of church membership. Church membership is for only believers. You cannot join the church if you're not a Christian. It's not for you. But, and so the issue is, you've got these people coming back and saying, we want to be a part of the church. And the church goes, I don't know if you're a Christian. And that's going to determine whether or not we welcome you back or not.
I mean, the question is, whether they're really defenders of the faith. I mean, at some point, you're watering things down.
Right. And so this boils down into a debate. And it happens in Rome. And you have some that say they're in favor and saying, yes, these people are Christians. They simply did something externally to save themselves or to save their families. Their children were at risk. Who wouldn't have done something like this? It was simply burning incense. And you're telling me you wouldn't, it's not okay to burn incense to save your child? And then on the other side, you've got some that say they didn't just burn incense. They renounced Christ. They turn their back on Jesus and on His bride. They're not Christians. Christians don't do that. And so this debate plays out in Rome. You got a guy named Novatian on one side. He's a Roman church leader, and he believed that the lapsed Christian should not be allowed back whatsoever. Cornelius, other side of the debate in the Church of Rome, believed that the lapsed should be allowed back, but to Sue's credit, after a period of penance. They need to make up for it, so to speak. And so both men, Novatian and Cornelius, sort of campaign to be the next bishop of Rome, because the last few have been executed. And so they do. They campaign and they push and they fight and they sort of try to garner support. Cornelius wins and he becomes the next bishop of Rome. And he says the lapsed can come back after a period of penance. And it becomes this accepted practice of the church. Novatian, however, does not take the defeat lying down. He says, nope, you're all wrong. You're all heretics. You're no longer the true church. I'm leaving and I'm starting my own. And he does. He says that the church is compromising their faith. They're watering it down too much. And so he encourages others to come with him. And people do. And in Novatian's mind and in his followers' mind, he says, that's no longer, the church in Rome and the church around the world, they're no longer the true church. Which means their baptisms no longer count. You cannot be saved by their people or by their bishops or through their preaching. They aren't the church. We are. And so everyone who joins Novatian gets rebaptized. Because their first baptism didn't count because it was by a false church. And so he rebaptizes and begins preaching the gospel and growing a church of his own separate entity. He doesn't preach anything heretical. He doesn't preach anything that's against the theology of the primary church. He simply just breaks off and says, that's not the church. We are. Now, Novatian becomes highly legalistic, as you can imagine. He doesn't tolerate the failure of Christians under persecution. Do you think he's going to tolerate sins of Christians? No. Novatian begins preaching a gospel that says, once you become a Christian, once you are baptized as a believer, you are to be spiritually perfect. Or else. And so you have Novatian sort of splitting off and forming his own thing, which is when, to set the context of Cyprian of Carthage, and all the theology and the high view of the church that he develops in the face of Novatian. And so Cyprian writes very highly of the church, that the visible church matters, that this is the true church, that lapsed Christians can still be faithful Christians and do penance and all these things. And he writes all of these things about this how great the church is, because that group over there is saying they're not the true church. And Cyprian's saying, absolutely we are. Now again, Cyprian, we need to remember, was in Carthage when Decius comes in and starts looking for bishops and church leaders to execute him. Cyprian runs, he leaves and he hides. And by all accounts, that was an apostate act. He left when the church needed him to lead. And so, of course, Cyprian's going to say, welcome back the lapsed, because I'm one of them.
Was Cyprian also the lapsed?
Say that again?
Was Cyprian black since he was from
Africa? Yeah, probably. Yeah. So Cyprian is, his theology of the church that he writes, holding up and elevating this high view of the church, becomes actually the dominant ecclesiology, the dominant doctrine of the church for the Catholic Church for thousands of years. And I called him Captain Church last week for a reason, because he, the writing that he, the theology that he develops and lays out in the face of Novation becomes solidified as Catholic Church doctrine for thousands of years. All right, questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest difference is that Peter didn't have the Holy Spirit. If we're looking at theologically, like this is before Christ dies, before he rises again, before Pentecost, that Peter denies Christ. So Peter's essentially on his own when he denies Christ. And then afterwards, he's baptized, receives the Spirit, does all these things. Right? So what's happening here is we're talking about people who've already been baptized, who've already received the Holy Spirit, who've already been faithful Christians, and now are denying Christ. Peter denied Christ before he became a Christian, so to speak.
What time and place, because you touched on Socrates and Plato.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that,
Before.
Before
Christ.
Oh, they were before?
Mm-hmm.